Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Join us for an in-depth look at Iowa agriculture. Here are your hosts, Dustin Hoffman and Anna Hastert.
Welcome back to another edition of Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. I'm Dustin Hoffman, your host this week, and to my left, Anna Hastert. How are you?
I'm doing pretty all right. How about yourself, Dustin?
Hey, you can't go wrong with pretty all right.
Nope, we're headed into the weekend, so I really can't complain.
And kind of a short week for us next week. That doesn't happen often, but we get a short week next week with Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the shortened week, not because I don't have to come into work, but I get to spend time with family, eat lots of good food. I was in an email with somebody. I told them, make sure that you say yes, please, to all the food that's passed towards you. I mean, you don't want to turn down turkey stuffing, cranberry sauce, or whatever it is that everybody likes to partake in on this holiday. But yeah, make sure that you never say no to the food that's coming around the table.
And I'm looking forward to my mom's second greatest creation behind me is her stuffing. And she makes it once a year at Thanksgiving. And it is, oh my gosh, I can already taste it. In fact, it is so good, I usually don't eat stuffing the whole month of November until Thanksgiving. Because I don't want to taint my taste buds for missing that.
Oh, jeez. That's so excessive.
I got to ask the age-old question on the cranberry sauce. Do you do cranberry sauce?
Sometimes, yeah. But my grandma does like a different rendition of cranberry sauce.
She makes her own?
Well, no. Sometimes, yeah. And it's pretty good. But sometimes she'll make cranberry salad. So it's like a jello salad almost with cranberries in it. And I do prefer that over the cranberry
that
sauce.
That doesn't sound bad. We used to make homemade cranberry sauce with the orange juice and stuff. But my favorite, I don't care what anybody says, it's the jelly cranberry from the can. Oh. Nothing says Thanksgiving until you hear right there on the plate.
Oh, my.
That's one of my favorite things. So, you know, Thanksgiving, of course, you know, turkey's always being the big thing, you know, in the poultry industry. You know, we definitely want to support those farmers out there raising those turkeys. So, quick rundown of what we've been covering this week. Anna, what have you been following?
Yeah, so you mentioned that we're going to have a shortened week next week because of the holiday, but this week has been a little bit slow. We've seen a lot of back and forth with trade negotiations with China. Still can't get anything figured out there yet. And aside from that, a couple things that I've been looking at this week, the National Pork Board just revamped their pork checkoff, now calling it Pork Checkoff 4.0. And David Newman, president of the National Pork Board, will talk about that in my segment here up next. And then Channel Seed has actually launched a grain marketing podcast. So if you're struggling with developing a grain marketing plan for the upcoming year, go give that a listen. We have a link to that on our website, iowaagnet.com. Really useful information, as Matt Bennett, who's grain marketing consultant with Channel Seed, says a lot of farmers do struggle with putting together a grain marketing plan. And it's okay. It's okay if that's you too. But make sure you use these resources and make sure you got everything figured out heading into the new year, especially since we had a challenging year this year. How about you, Dustin?
You know, USMCA has been the big deal last week. We were excited because Speaker Pelosi said, well, the deal is imminent. This week she said maybe 2020. And now even Ranking Member Stabenow, the Senate Ag Committee, said, let's pump the brakes on this. And I know a lot of farm groups aren't going to want to hear that. But let's go ahead and get into your segment about the pork checkoff.
A pork industry representative spoke to exciting changes taking place at the National Pork Board. We welcome David Newman, National Pork Board President. Joined here today at Trade Talk with David Newman. He is president of the National Pork Board. David, some exciting new changes are coming to the National Pork Board in regards to the pork checkoff. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
That's right. Thank you. So we do have a lot of exciting changes going on right now, and the biggest one probably being that we have recently approved and are launching an entirely new pork checkoff program. So we're calling that the Checkoff 4.0. In 1986, when the Pork Act and Order was passed, that was 1.0. And as things have changed and producers' needs have changed, we have redesigned the organization around the responsible allocation of producers' dollars. That's my responsibility as the president of the board, is making sure that we are responsibly putting those dollars into the correct buckets that helps move U.S. pork. In the 4.0, it's really about the fact that in the age we're in, everything is moving so fast. Technology is changing very quickly. Our producers need a system at Chekhov that's doing the same thing, that's adapting technologies, that is moving quickly, that is, to use something we say quite often, moving with the speed of business. And that's what 4.0 does. And instead of being branched out into a huge number of buckets, we've really narrowed this down to two pieces. And those two pieces are to add value and build trust. So building trust is on our We Care principles. That's things talking about the environment, animal welfare, food safety, the core principles that our producers live by, engaging in the community. The add value piece is, of course, extremely important. That is the marketing of 130 million hogs a year, both domestically and internationally. So we have some really exciting stuff going on with 4.0 that I think our producers are going to be very excited about.
Yeah, and one of the aspects that you look to focus on with the change and with Pork 4.0 is kind of the multicultural aspect. Can you tell us a little bit more about that piece?
When we're talking about multicultural, we're not just talking about international marketing. I mean, that is something with our biggest trading partners we've talked about for years. Mexico, Canada, China, South Korea, Japan, that are huge consumers of pork. But our multicultural sector in the United States and domestically is growing at an unprecedented rate. So we are putting a lot of focus on that area currently in our multicultural department marketing area. We have Jose De Jesus, who runs that, and he's a terrific guy who's got some great programs going on. And what's important to understand about multicultural and the research that we've conducted at the National Pork Board is that they shop differently. We want to be able to really tackle that Latino market and give them the products that they want, because they are huge consumers of pork, which is fascinating, and we love that. And so we're looking at fabricating the carcass a different way, reaching out to them in retail, how we get to them through a communications effort as well, because the buying power of the multicultural segment in the U.S., specifically to Latinos, is worth about $1.7 trillion. Now, that's everything, but when it comes to protein, pork is number one, and we want to be able to make sure that we're focusing on that. That's just one example of a numerous number of examples that says this is how we want to focus. We want to focus on people who eat pork. We want them to continue to eat pork, and we want to engage with them about its safety and its value as a protein.
Earlier, you mentioned that Pork 4.0 focuses on building trust and adding value. Let's talk about the importance of those key items in a time like today where you guys face a little bit of uncertainty in your certain market. Let's talk about how those two things will help pork farmers in the future.
The key points are this. As most of our listening audience who are in agriculture know, less than 3% of the population is represented by production ag. So what we need to do is make sure we're not only telling our own story to our own people about the ethical principles we live by every day, but we need to be telling the other 97% of consumers out in the world what it is that we do. And we're really focused on people, pigs, and planet. That's something we talk about a lot. So Pork Chekhov 4.0, it is going to be consumer-focused and producer-led. And those words are very important. I mean, being consumer-focused means let's talk to our consumers about what we do to be responsible stewards of the land. Let's talk to our consumers about what we do to ensure food safety. Let's talk to our consumers about what we do in on-farm practices every day for animal welfare. So that building trust piece is very, very important. And from an add value standpoint, we do not have a shortage of pork here in the United States. And as we have been looking at not only domestic opportunities, which we have a tremendous amount of domestic opportunities, we need to learn how to market pork. We used an example of multicultural earlier. That's a great one. Also, Generation Z, millennials, the new consumers, how do they eat? What do they want to see with pork as a protein? Then whenever you move into our international segment, of course, emerging and developing markets are going to become huge for us. We've embarked on part of our 4.0 messaging, or programming rather, with Dr. Norman Bissac, who heads our international marketing department. He's looking at a program called Pork 2040. So not just who's the markets now. Japan is a good example, has been a tremendous trading partner for U.S. pork for decades. But what will that look like in 2040? And there are countries who are going to emerge as being very advantageous for U.S. pork that we're not thinking about today. But Chekhov, we are thinking about them today. And we want to be sure that we're getting boots on the ground and understanding their culture, understanding what type of products they want. And that's going to help hold the market up. That's going to help us continue to provide our families with the resources they need by really capturing value from the one thing we produce, and that's pork.
That was David Newman, president of the National Pork Board. For more information about National Pork Board, visit pork.org. I'm Anna Hostert with This Week in Ag Matters segment. Stay tuned for more news and information.
During November Hunger Month, remember that 1 in 9 people in Iowa struggle with hunger. 1 in 7 of those are children. The annual cost to feed all who are hungry costs over $157 million per year. Please consider donating to your food banks. You can also help package, prepare, or deliver meals to those in need. In a land as bountiful as ours, there's no reason for anybody to be going without food. Take time to pledge and help your fellow Iowans get the food they need. This message from your friends at the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. Here's your host, Dustin Hoffman.
As farmers are getting ready to put the finishing touches on the 2019 harvest, we have to be sure that we're aware of what we're doing to prepare for 2020. I'm being joined right now by Dr. Greg Tilka of Iowa State University. He is a nematologist there. Dr. Tilka, thank you for taking a few minutes to join us here on Weekend Ag Matters.
Sure. I'm happy to talk to you, Dustin. Thank you.
So we heard a nematologist, and of course that always brings up everybody's favorite friend, a soybean cyst nematode.
Yep.
And we've got some information going on this year. And let's start with new areas that we've found that are containing this little dickens.
Well, it continues to spread. It's probably infested most of the fields in Iowa that we're going to find it, but in other parts of the country, it's kind of forging ahead into new fields and new counties. But it gives us an opportunity to remind farmers in Iowa that this is an insidious pest. It's every year rated the most damaging soybean pathogen in all of North America. And it's simple to test for. This fall is a great time to test for it. And then farmers, we can give them great information on how to actively manage it once they know what they're dealing with.
You know, I've heard the term the billion-dollar bug thrown around quite a bit, and it does do a lot of damage into that billion-dollar range for the soybean industry, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and that's really not an exaggeration. It's $1 billion for the United States soybean production. It's probably hundreds of millions of dollars just for Iowa. And it's a little bit frustrating because those numbers can be smaller if we were able to manage it a little better. We're never going to make it a $0 pest, but I want farmers to get as many bushels per acre off of their fields as they can, and certainly everybody needs that in these days of low commodity prices.
So we talked about testing the soil and now being the perfect time to do that. So what do farmers need to know, or what do they need to be doing to get those tests done and get them done in a timely fashion?
So the first thing is a farmer may have sampled a field in the past, and this isn't a one-test pest, if you will. I tell farmers, think of it kind of like high blood pressure. But for those who haven't sampled for it, they could have it and not know about it, just like high blood pressure. And then for those who have sampled in the past and know they've got it, just like high blood pressure, it's not a one-time test. When you go to the doctor's office, seems like no matter what you go to the doctor's office for, they immediately take your blood pressure because they want to monitor how the numbers are going. And that's what we need farmers who are managing soybean cyst nematode to do as well. So that's why there's a push, a national push, through a project called the SCN Coalition to have farmers test this fall so they can come up with an active management plan moving forward to 2020.
So when farmers are doing these tests, should they be testing every soybean field every year that they're doing, or every field, or how do they kind of stay on top of this?
Well, the fields that should be tested this fall would be ones that are planned to have soybeans in 2020. And then it's not an every soybean crop test that needs to be done. But I'd say at the most, every third soybean crop, every field should be tested so we know what the numbers are. So we're in a unique situation. We've been dealing with SCN in Iowa since the late 70s, and it really came to prominence in the 90s through the first SCN coalition, and now we have a new version of the coalition. Incidentally, that is funded in great part by soybean checkoff dollars, so from the Iowa farmers themselves, and a big thank you for that. But we've managed it fairly successfully with resistant soybeans, but all of those resistant soybean varieties had the same resistance genes. And much like using the same herbicide to control weeds, using the same resistant genes to control nematodes, the pest builds up resistance against the resistant. So we have farmers who've managed SCN quite well with resistant soybeans who are having their numbers gradually build up, and they may not know it because that resistance is starting to fail.
Okay, and I find it interesting how you brought up the comparison to soybean cyst nematode to high blood pressure, because I think quite a few farmers end up finding those little buggers in their field end up having high blood pressure the way it seems. But now, how does the bug spread? I mean, how does it move? I know we're pretty well infested here in Iowa, but if people are having lower counts and all of a sudden you're seeing more of them coming in, how are they spreading and how are we seeing those populations growing again?
Well, if a farmer has tested in the past and detects higher numbers now, it's probably not the result of an introduction of more SCN. It's probably that the resistance has slowly eroded in its effectiveness. But there are plenty of fields out there that don't have soybean cyst nematode or did not in the past that could have had it introduced through soil moved by floodwaters, torrential rains, just surface erosion. The big culprit, I think, in the Midwest is windblown soil. The soybean cyst nematode female, she swells up and she kind of looks like a lemon, and she's full of a couple hundred eggs, but that lemon-shaped female is the size of a period at the end of a printed sentence, like in a newspaper or something. So it's very, very small, easily could fit in a piece of soil that's blown on the wind if there's fall tillage being done or in the spring. So nobody can say that I'm never going to get soybean cyst nematode because it moves so freely.
All right. So is there anything you want to add here before we wrap up today, Dr. Tilka?
Well, I guess I would emphasize SCN is not a death sentence. Farmers could have it and not know about it, but the analogy with high blood pressure is a good one. Just like high blood pressure can be managed, so can SCN. There's lots of great research funded by the Soybean Checkoff, and all this information is compiled on a great website for the SCN Coalition, and that website address is the name of the project. It's thescncoalition.com with no spaces. So thescncoalition.com, and there's a bunch of state-specific information, including obviously information specific to farmers in the state of Iowa.
All right. Well, Dr. Tilka, I thank you very much for taking a few minutes to talk with us today and keep people up to date on what they need to be knowing with soybean cyst nematode.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity, Dustin. I really appreciate it.
That, again, was Dr. Greg Tilka of Iowa State University here on Weekend Ag Matters. We'll be back with Ken Root coming up right after the break.
How many acres are you keeping an eye on? Another pair of eyes could be very helpful in protecting your ROI, especially ones that are highly trained. And that's what you'll get with an FS Crop Specialist. They can spot issues you might not even know you have using the latest technology, including thermal, drone, and NDVI imaging. Then they can get an early treatment plan started. Contact your local FS Crop Specialist to learn more about our crop scouting services. It's one more way FS is bringing you what's next.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters, and now here's Ken Root.
There is a lot of talk about finding new markets for our corn and soybeans. China has been a great market, but competition and politics took part of it away, and our history of military engagement may cost us export sales there for a generation. What should we do? The same thing we always do, go and find new markets. The latest focus is on countries that have emerging economies. In other words, they now are living on the dirt, but their resources and population may elevate them skyward, bring a new middle class into existence, and generate enough wealth to change their diet to include more protein. The continent that comes to mind is Africa, and the countries include Nigeria and Ghana. I have not been to Nigeria, but 4 years ago I went to Ghana, a West African neighbor, as I was traveling with a USDA trade mission. The trip I took to the sub-Saharan country of Ghana was led by Deputy Secretary Krista Hardin back during the Obama administration. The goal of the group of business and government leaders was to strengthen relationships with an emerging nation and to evaluate potential business opportunities in West Africa. Ghana is an agricultural country and is looking at selling into Nigeria if that country takes off in its economic development. Ghana was formerly called the Gold Coast and has lots of resources. Its 27 million people are blessed with gold, diamonds, and oil. Ghana is proudly the 78th least corrupt country in the world. Nigeria is 144th of 175 countries rated. West Africans speak softly, but they drive wildly. A car with a broken horn is inoperable, and staying on the right side of the road is only a suggestion. We focused on agricultural capacity, noting the country leads the world in cocoa production. After a harrowing drive to the outskirts of Accra, the capital city, we were shown a quiet cocoa farm with tropical trees with green and yellow pods hanging from the trunks. The ripe 10-inch-long seed pods are broken open with a stick, and the large seeds, about the size of a Brazil nut, are scooped out and piled for solar heating to get most of the moisture out. They're then placed on tables covered with mats in the very hot tropical sun until they can be stored. Even at that point, the cocoa flavor is minimal and requires extensive processing to get the kind of flavor we expect. Farms are many in number and small in size. There is literally no mechanization past the woven mats and discarded plastic buckets. The women are more involved in farming than their husbands. This is a theme throughout Africa, and one that Secretary Hardin seized upon many times during our trip. Her goal was to empower the women farmers to be leaders. Contending the strength and stability they bring to the family unit will also be the foundation of the entire country. There's a contradiction playing out worldwide that we saw. Farmers, working with a hoe, living in a hut, and walking barefoot, have cell phones and watch television. Their government claims TV has a 96% penetration in their society, and over 80,000 farmers have a cell phone. There are also many radio stations in several languages. As a result, divisions of government and non-governmental organizations are focusing on direct communication with the masses. I met with an organization called A Green Revolution for Africa that works in concert with the U.S. Agency for International Development. I was shown an example of a weekly reality show on farming. The production was well done, and the concept for the non-commercial half hour is to have the host and video producers go to a farm to help a farmer improve production. A woman who raised rice on about 1 acre was the subject. Through expert advice from the local agricultural retailer and extension information, she was coaxed into changing from growing rice by seeding on dry soil to cultivating the crop in a paddy. Her tillage equipment was the most rudimentary, but the agency promoted planting certified seed that had germination above 80%. She transplanted green shoots every 20 centimeters into the muck of the paddy and placed a supersized granule of fertilizer equidistant between every 4 plants. At the end of the growing season, the cameras returned to show she had increased production from 1,000 pounds dry land to 2,400 pounds. It initially airs each week on Sunday at 3 p.m. The most innovative technology was short message system or text to farmers by region and crops. It's funded by USAID and Vodafone, the largest cell phone distributor in the country. The messages are short, but each one is aimed at the needs of the farmer at that moment in time, and there are homemaker tips as well. They also have a call center that takes inquiries from farmers to provide more explanation of topics offered by the text. Operators say that some farmers call for information, and others call them to just talk. Ghana's future, and that of Nigeria, is unsure, but the current trend shows rice production in Ghana up 53% over the previous year, and more technical support for all agricultural enterprises. Processors are willing to buy locally grown products, but they want them to be as safe and cheap as the imports they receive today. Nigeria, with almost 200 million people, is projected to have the world's greatest population growth between now and 2050. It appears to me it will either grow in production and purchasing power or fall into disease and famine. Foreign aid and investment reflects the immediacy of need. However, the outcome really lies in the hands of the Africans, not outsiders. If Nigeria rises and a middle class is developed, we could sell a great deal of our agricultural products there, and countries around Nigeria, such as Ghana, can sell their products into the country as well. I'm Ken Root on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Thank you, Ken, and that's all for this edition of Weekend Ag Matters. We thank you for tuning in with us here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. You can find replays of this show as well as all of our other content online at iowaagnet.com. Don't forget to find us on Twitter and Facebook at Iowa Ag Radio. On behalf of myself, Anna Hastert, and Ken Root, we thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on Weekend Ag Matters.